This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The flu is unpredictable. Each year, we are cautioned to get a flu shot, and this year, millions did. But after that vaccine was developed and administered, this year's flu mutated, rendering the vaccine ineffective for many. As a result, this year's influenza has reached epidemic proportions, with many being hospitalized and with the reported deaths of at least 26 children from the illness. And we're only halfway through flu season. One of the scientists working to better understand the flu and other viruses that can be transmitted from human to human and from animal to human is UNC Charlotte's Dr. Dan Janis, and we're going to pick his brain about this year's flu strain, why it mutated, and why flus are so hard to predict. But we also want to talk about something he's developed, a supramap that can help predict how infectious pathogens are spreading and mutating around the world. Dr. Janis, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
And as we go through this, I know people will have questions about all of this, and you can email them to us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or do it through Facebook or Twitter. How many different flu viruses are there? Do you know? Do we know?
No. There are many, many combinations. But many people describe the flu through only two of its parts, the surface proteins. However,
that's the H and the N.
The H and the N.
When we hear HN and H1N1.
Yeah.
Okay. What are the two? What's the H and the N stand for?
H is hemagglutinin.
Mm-hmm. Has to do with the blood? No?
No. Okay. Has to do with some of the reactions it causes. They're basically enzymes.
Okay.
The N is an enzyme, neuraminidase.
Okay.
And those are only two of the 10 to 11 proteins the flu makes out of 8 genes. It's very efficient, makes many more proteins than has genes. And it's really a historical system, the nomenclature, because we used antibodies to detect those, the H and the N. They're on the surface of the virus. And we didn't detect the internal genes of the virus. Now with genomics, we can detect all those genes, and so it's much more.
So we didn't used to be able to do this, but now we can.
Correct.
And we're going to talk about this because you say the way we look at this is wrong. It's outdated, and it's based on old technology.
That's correct.
Okay. So if this thing is able to mutate and make lots of different combinations resulting in different kinds of flu, are the possibilities endless?
Virtually, yes.
Okay.
There are two major processes. One, mutation, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. and the other is shuffling these 8 segments like you shuffle a deck of cards and making completely new constellations of genes into the virus.
Which makes it seems to me, almost impossible to keep up with and certainly very difficult to predict.
That's true.
Even with this new technology where we can look beyond the H's and the N's, is that making it easier to predict what the season's going to be like, or is it making it even more complex because it is more complex?
Well, the observational technology has improved a lot, but putting all that information in context is the challenge in understanding where the flu might go. So prediction is still a very difficult thing to do.
Do flus ever come around again in exactly the same form?
Rarely. And they would go extinct because our immune system – that's what we're preparing ourselves for with vaccines and our own innate immunity. So those flus go extinct mm-hmm. and it's adapt or die for new lineages.
I've talked to lots of scientists about viruses and germs, and I just can't get my head around this. And I know there are people out there going to kick the radio across the room if I ask this question. But I'm going to ask it anyway. These things are not intelligent thinking creatures. How do they know that if they stay the same, they're going to die out because we're going to become immune? Why do they mutate? What's in it for them? I know life is in it for them, or whatever it is. It's not really life, is it? Existence is in it for them.
Yeah.
But how do they know that?
Well, they're just wonderfully sloppy in their reproduction, and many, many combinations are made, and some survive and
some
go extinct, and there's no design necessarily.
So every year scientists get together and they try to predict, they try to guess what the dominant flu strain is going to be so that they can produce a flu shot mm-hmm. that protects us against it. How do they make that prediction?
Well, they try to aggregate the existing science. They use a lot of genomics nowadays and build evolutionary trees, sort of branching diagrams representing the flu. And the flu, those trees tend to look like pine trees, and they're looking at the leading edges, those new soft needles on the pine trees, so to speak.
And that's based on what happened last year?
Yeah, and, okay. and the virus is at the leading edge of this ever-growing evolutionary tree of flu strains. Mm-hmm. And then they have a committee meeting, frankly, and they decide what three viruses will be represented in the vaccine.
Why only three?
I think they can do four now, but that's traditional to do three.
So because these flus recombine and they shuffle their own decks, they still have elements of previous flus in the new flu, perhaps, correct?
Yeah.
So if I've had a flu, and gosh knows I've had the flu many times, but if I've had a flu that has elements of the deck, the shuffled deck, well, if I get the flu again, will my flu be less severe than perhaps a newborn baby's flu who doesn't have any experience with the flu?
That's correct. Yeah.
So that's how it works.
Yes.
Just like it's always 5 o'clock somewhere in the world, is it always flu season somewhere in the world?
Yes, and we're just beginning to be able to observe that because previously the development of flu labs was limited to major population centers. But now we're starting to recognize flu around the world.
And as scientists get together to predict what the flu season in North America is going to be like, they're looking not just at what it was like here last year, but what it's doing elsewhere where it is right now, flu season. In the middle of July, they're looking at what's going on somewhere about what's happening with that flu. And that's what they're looking at and what they're working with.
Yes.
Why do we have a flu season? What is it about this time of year that makes us susceptible to the flu as opposed to the middle of July?
Well, it's not exclusively so, but one of the best reasons I've heard before sort of has to do with the physics of spit, frankly, that the respiratory droplets are transmitted better in the dry air of the winter season.
Because we are coughing more, or because we just talk and it floats out into the atmosphere more easily,
and it transports better human to human.
If I'm going to use the word, if I spit in the course of talking to you and it lands on this piece of paper, and I have the flu and I don't know it yet, and I hand this piece of paper to you and you touch it, are you likely to get the flu from that? Is the virus still alive on that piece of paper
for some time? Yes.
How long do we know?
I think a couple hours.
A couple of hours.
Yeah.
Wow.
I would have to fact check that.
Now, the flus that we get in this country come from people, right? Mostly.
Primarily.
But where do they start?
Well, wild birds harbor almost every kind of influenza. Some of those influenzas are deadly to those birds. Some the birds are not affected by.
But their respiratory system is not affected by their flus, are they? Doesn't it affect them someplace else, or is it their respiratory system?
Different flus affect them in different ways, certainly respiratory. Their respiratory system is actually very different than ours, and one of the ways the flu adapts is changing itself to go from an avian to a mammalian respiratory
system. So how do we – because most of us don't live on a farm. We don't handle chickens. We don't go out and pick up cardinals and robins. How do we get it from them?
Well, in certain cases, like what's going on with H7N9 in China now, it starts with people who do handle poultry. There's a lot of live bird markets in China, and live birds are preferred. And so that virus gets a foothold in those populations and then moves person to person after
so
that.
So if you have a farm and you're raising chickens or turkeys or pheasants, and if you are – well, we just did a program on this – an urban homesteader, and you have chickens in your backyard because you want them for the eggs or you want to fry up a chicken every once in a while, are you at greater risk? Can you tell from looking at the birds you have that these birds are harboring the flu?
Yes. When there are bird die-offs, you must – kill all the birds within a certain radius of that farm. And that's happening right now in Washington State and British Columbia with a new avian influenza.
It isn't just avian influenza. There's the swine flu, and that comes from hogs, right?
That's correct. But all these genes infect all kinds of animals. These monikers that it's a swine or an avian influenza are really just ways of simplifying our world.
So there are far more flus than we contract, but they are contracted from bird to bird, pig to pig, Can a pig flu jump into a bird population and vice versa?
Yeah, they're very labile. Yeah.
What makes this happen? What makes a flu that has been confined to a bird suddenly jump into the human population?
Well, remember a couple of years ago, those experiments with ferrets where H5N1, this very deadly avian flu, was mutated in the lab and it was found to transmit between ferrets? That's happening in nature too a little bit, okay? Not to the extent that virus was, but certain mutations, just one point in the virus can change, for example, to allow an avian influenza to adapt to the mammalian respiratory tract.
And what is it about that change that makes it able to impact us?
The protein changes its shape a little bit and interacts with the cells of our respiratory cells a little bit better.
Now, in previous stories that I've read and seen about the flu, Asia seems to be the epicenter of avian flus. Is that true? And if so, why?
Historically so, and yes. But think again to our H1N1 experience here in the Americas, where flu seems to have been emerged out of Mexico and the United States. So it's not exclusively Asia, but Asia does provide a lot of the new lineage.
But why? Is it something they're doing with animals that we don't do that makes that particularly a fertile ground for flu?
Yeah, incredibly close, dense populations who harbor live animals in like grocery stores.
Is the swine flu also an Asian epicentered disease, or does that come from another part of the world?
The viruses of the swine flu the genes of the viruses that caused the H1N1 pandemic in 2009 contained elements of virus genes circulating in Asia and Europe, as well as the Americas. So it's really it's like a car. Parts are come from all over the world, but they're assembled in a factory in Mexico.
The flu has the reputation of being one of the most deadly, dangerous diseases to afflict people. Does it deserve that reputation?
Depends on the strain. So H5N1, for example, kills 60% of the people who are infected by it. H1N1 from the pandemic didn't kill very many people, but it was very successful, and that's how pandemics are defined by geography. It's spread around the world very rapidly.
But there are all kinds of cold viruses, the common cold. And we can't get the same cold twice. If we get a cold in January and we get a cold in March, it's a different virus. For the same reason you mentioned with the flu, if I'm not mm-hmm. overstating my message here, that you become immune to the virus once mm-hmm. you've gotten over it. We don't generally die from the cold. Why do we die from the flu?
Well, in young people and who have healthy immune systems, it causes an sort of overreaction, like a positive feedback loop in your immune system, and you die from that.
And that's more – that doesn't happen with the cold virus? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, largely so.
Have you looked at the cold virus? What are the principal differences in the cold – because they both affect our respiratory system.
Yeah. So the – metaphor I like to use is a pie chart. Mm-hmm. So imagine a pie chart. If you look at what's circulating in terms of respiratory illnesses, only a third of that pie chart is influenza. The rest are other kinds of viruses, coronaviruses, okay. Adenoviruses, rhinoviruses.
Dr. Dan Janis is an expert on the flu. He's got all kinds of things to talk about the other flus that have not reached us here yet and how we track the flu now or how he's tracking it. And we'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, local blood supplier to 27 of the region's hospitals. Blood donations are down due to cold and flu season. Only local blood donors can meet the needs of area patients. CBCC.us. Well, no matter our race, each of us sees the world in different ways. But as recent events would indicate, when you mix race into the equation, we can have very different views of the same event. Well, Stephanie Robinson has been working on getting below the surface of that reality and changing it. She's a lecturer at Harvard Law. She's appeared regularly on the Tom Joyner Morning Show and with the Tavis Smiley's organization. And she will join us to talk about efforts that she's going to be conducting here in Charlotte in the coming weeks, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, nearly 3 million new jobs were created last year in the U.S., but these positions were largely for low-wage work. Who's working? Who's not? And prospects for the 2015 economy.
Join that discussion on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the flu, and we'll get into genomics. We'll get into emerging diseases and how they're being tracked across the world and how we know more about the flu than we used to, so that the descriptives like H1N1 and H5N1 are not sufficient really anymore. And we're talking about this with Dr. Dan Janis, who is the Carol Grotnes-Belk Distinguished Professor of Bioinformatics and Genomics at UNC Charlotte. Just prior to the break, when I was pushing you to stop talking because we were coming up to the break, you were talking about this pie chart, because I had asked you about why we don't die from cold viruses, but we do die sometimes from the flu virus. And yet they both affect our respiratory system. Expand on that a little bit. Expand on the pie chart aspect of this a little bit.
Well, imagine city by city a chart of the viruses circulating. A third of that chart is typically influenza. Within that third, there can be different strains of influenza. But the other 66% is made of coronaviruses, rhinoviruses, perhaps bacteria. And so when you say influenza or respiratory-like illnesses, there's really a lot going on under the hood. And that pie chart, that distribution of different bacteria and viruses, will change over time and space. And I think that's what we have to work towards.
Do flu viruses mutate more than most other viruses that we catch?
Yeah, the flu is very sloppy in its reproduction. And
more so than the cold virus, more so than Ebola.
It's better studied as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So those other viruses do mutate rapidly too. But
you say the flu virus is able to move between geographically separate populations through the trans-global travel of some of its various hosts. Are you talking about birds here or humans or both?
Both.
So we have exacerbated the spread of the flu because of air travel?
Yes, but in 1918, that virus got almost all around the world, and we didn't have rapid air travel.
How did that happen?
That's a mystery. People think it might be the soldiers returning from World War I.
Because it coincided with that in 1918.
Yeah.
We normally talk about the H7N1. There are others like the H7N9. We talked about what the H and the N mean. What do the numbers mean?
First antibody, second antibody, third antibody, and so forth. Just different reactions to different chemical reactions.
So the N1 is different from the N2.
That's correct.
Our body would react to it differently.
That's correct.
Okay. You recently released a paper about the H7N9 flu virus, which takes what is described as a more complex and daunting view of the virus, your analysis. You say this not just as a steadily changing virus, but as regularly shuffling a combination of 11 genes, each with its own history, back and forth from species to species, including ducks and chickens and wild birds and humans. Mm-hmm. So the implications of this new way of looking at the flu are what?
Well, we'd like to work towards something akin to a weather map for infectious diseases, watching through genomics how the genes change themselves, but also how the genes are moving over time and space. And so we've been able to put genes in the context of maps, and we think we can start to build a better sort of surveillance of the spread of infectious diseases such so we can prepare better.
Now, how do you collect that information? Just from reports of people going to the doctor, going to hospitals for the illness? How do you collect that?
That would be syndromic surveillance, and we're doing some of that. And that's what your county epidemiologist does. Mm-hmm. But what we want to do is drill down into what's causing those symptoms and look at the cause of the disease themselves, the pathogen itself. So we're going from sort of patient or symptom-centric surveillance to genetic surveillance of diseases.
And you've also said that the relatively rapid mutation rate you've talked about the relatively rapid mutation rate and that the genes experience a wide variety of host and environmental conditions. The possibilities for dangerous new viral adaptations are constant. This is not something new. This is our knowledge of it is new.
Yes, genomics has opened a lot of new avenues for looking at this. And I think part of the reason we had a pandemic in 2009 is because we could see it. And, you know, the worldwide spread of viruses has always been occurring, but now we can observe it better.
So every year we will hear predictions about, well, it's going to be a mild flu season, or it's going to be a really bad flu season. It depends on what the year is and what the scientists are looking at. But what I gather from what you're saying is that you can never be too sure about that because of what happened this year. Because of these mutations and the shuffling of the deck, it could always be a bad flu season.
Yes.
you're not filling me with great hope here. Does this rapid mutation rate exist only in this H7N9 strain, or is it throughout the whole thing?
All flus. Yeah.
And now that we can look at it at the genetic level, are we able to fight it better? Will we eventually be able to fight it better?
Well, I think there's sort of two avenues. One is this idea of better surveillance, sort of taking a weather map approach so we can understand what's happening around mm-hmm. the world and better prepare, okay? So use medical intelligence. And there are other people, not my lab, but working on approaches to universal vaccines that do not target highly variable parts of the influenza genes, but relatively more conserved parts, such that those vaccines may work year after year.
Well, that was going to be my question. Since we can look at this at the genetic level, and we do this with all kinds of tools, including computers, mm-hmm. If we know that one medical drug component goes after the N1 and a different goes after the N3, can we not come up with the drug for all of the millions of possible combinations, or at least do it very quickly when we know that this is the virus this year, or these are the three viruses or four viruses that are really dominant. Oh, there's been a mutation. Now there's this one coming in. Can't we then look at it using computers and compounds and formulate a new vaccine just like that?
Yes, that is a sort of a third avenue for improvement. Is more rapid production of vaccines or on-demand production.
Except for the fact that we keep being told that they have to come up with these vaccines months in advance because of the process that they use, which involves eggs mm-hmm. in the production of the vaccine. Talk about how we do these, how we produce these viruses now and why we have to produce them in that way.
Well, eggs is a tried and true way of doing it. It was actually one of my first jobs in science in Parc Davis, which became part of Pfizer eventually. There are other technologies, cell culture, and even raising a virus in tobacco plants, in engineered tobacco plants, which are promising.
Why tobacco?
There are ways to infect it and grow it rapidly. And in mass.
Why does it even grow in a tobacco plant? It likes the tissue, living animal tissue. Why does it like plant tissue?
Because there's a way to get the genes into the tobacco cells, and it grows rapidly within them and produce. You don't need to produce the whole virus. You just need to produce the proteins upon which you make the vaccine.
Does that make the tobacco dangerous?
No.
Okay. But the egg, the way we make these vaccines now is we take some of the virus and we culture it in the albumen of the, is that right, of the egg?
Yes.
Why does it take so long? Why do we do it that way? Could we do it other ways that would make it much quicker? Why?
I think the tobacco method is really good. It's okay. Even been applied to Ebola. It's one of the methods for Ebola vaccines as well, or Ebola treatment.
This H7N9 strain, which has it come here yet?
Has not escaped
China. But it was relatively contained between birds until it jumped into humans in China in March of 2013. That's what I read someplace. But you say that parts of it can be traced back to 1902. It's been around a long time.
Yeah. And that's only because those are the oldest isolates in the refrigerator that have been recently sequenced, thawed out and sequenced. I'm sure it's been around, or those parts have been around for thousand years.
And as I understand it, that virus, the H7N9 strain, spreads from chickens to humans, but not human to human. Is that correct?
There have been some family clusters which were thought to be the first cases of human-to-human spread, but there's debate in the literature about the reality of that. So it remains to be seen.
So why would that be, that we could catch it from a chicken, but we can't catch it from each other? What's going on there?
That the virus has not become adapted well to back to the physics of spit, to transmitting between humans.
So when we get it from a chicken, what we're getting it from touching the chicken? We're getting it from being around the chicken's droppings? What are we getting it from?
That's correct. Most of the cases have occurred from people in China who are working with live poultry.
Are there things environmentally that cause a virus like a flu virus to mutate? Is it temperature? Is it the biological makeup of a particular host that suddenly it goes, if I do this, I can spread faster? Is there something that we understand about why these things do what they do?
I think it's always out there as a possibility. There's always possibilities for infection, but I think overpopulation and people interacting with wild animals for food or in other ways is really what's spawning a lot of new disease outbreaks. There's many more going on than influenza.
You think that the use of these – and we've talked about this a little bit – the use of these letters and numbers to describe the various strains like H3N2, H1N1, H5N1, H7N9 – they're also subgrouped into A and B categories, I'm told. What do the A's and B's stand for?
Influenza A is a big group of viruses. There's influenza B, which also infects humans. There's influenza C, which does not infect humans.
Okay. But you say this is a legacy nomenclature based on weak technology.
Yeah.
And in fact, that the H1N1 virus that killed 50 to 100 million people in 1918, that's hard to conceive. But that virus is nothing like the H1N1 that returned in 2009, because everything in the virus other than the H and the N were completely different.
Yes.
That's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
So how do scientists such as yourself keep track of all of this? Why do we even call it the same thing? Because it's not the same thing.
It's just a legacy nomenclature. Really, what we should do is consider the whole genomes. And you asked earlier how we're tracking this information. There are centralized repositories where scientists from all over the world put in the raw information. And really, that's the coin of the realm, is those whole genomes.
So what would you call it? If now that we know more than we knew when we were calling things by numbers and letters, and only two letters at that, how would you name these variants?
Well, we don't necessarily have to name them. We put them in a context of an evolutionary tree, and we look at the groups of those viruses in the tree, and we look at the features of those viruses. So I would name them based on these groups called clades, essentially.
Could there be a flu epidemic like the 1918 flu epidemic today, given that we are probably more advanced scientifically and medically? Could there be a devastating flu like that again?
Yeah, certainly. That was the concern in 2009, but vaccination is more widespread. Medical care is better. We have antiviral medicines like Tamiflu, which work on some flus, not all. So, and I think with Ebola, we knew that about that virus. It's really just a breakdown in the medical systems in West Africa.
How do these antivirals work? I mean, I'm interested to hear you say that Tamiflu works, because you watch these television commercials and you think, well, they're selling me a drug. But you're saying that it does, against certain strains of the flu, it does work. How does it work?
It's also controversial. It's supposed to reduce the ability of the virus to replicate itself in your body and reduce the severity of the illness. And
how?
Certainly. It attacks the neuraminidase enzyme. So the virus, when making new copies of itself, does not escape from your cells.
How did we discover that this would work? I mean, what's in an over-the-counter drug like Tamiflu that is so powerful. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's a small molecule that interferes with the structure of the enzyme, and the enzyme's efficiency is diminished.
We get sick from lots of different things, bacteria, viruses. There are other pathogens that we get sick from. But viruses seem to be very challenging for scientists. What is it about viruses? Because there's so many of them, and there's so many of them now that we're recently discovering, like HIV, like Ebola, and there are others, the hantaviruses and things like that. What is it about viruses that is so challenging?
Well, I mean, initially you couldn't see them. You couldn't perceive them. And now genomics allows us to perceive them. So we're going to discover more by the nature of the technology. But the most fascinating thing is it's really evolution in real time. It's not conceptual. You can actually see it happening.
So we can't keep up with it.
That's correct. We can improve our ability to provide supportive care and improve our ability to make vaccines and antivirals. But it'll always be an arms race that we're partially losing.
And is there something going on in the world today? Because since the 1980s, suddenly, is it just our awareness of viruses? But because since the 1980s, we're suddenly aware of new viruses and deadly ones at that. HIV first appeared, at least in this country, in I think the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It was in Africa before that, but we didn't know what it was. Ebola has been in the news constantly this year, and we used to think of it as a very contained in the jungle kind of thing in Africa. What is it about these viruses suddenly appearing and suddenly leaping across the world?
Well, I think viruses are opportunistic. So, yes, Ebola was a Central African disease, and it looks like bats are probably responsible for transporting it to West Africa, and people in West Africa have been interacting with bats and eating bats, and they have poor health infrastructure, and then you have an epidemic on your hands.
But that's still been relatively contained. The only cases of Ebola that have come to the United States have been people who have come here from Africa, and usually people in close proximity, medical workers, to the people suffering from Ebola. That was not the case with HIV.
Correct.
Why? And it came from, we think it came from monkeys, correct? Eating monkey meat?
That's correct.
So why did that virus spread so quickly?
It was a different time, and it was sexually transmitted, and people who have come to Western countries or even neighboring countries to the three major affected places in West Africa for Ebola, people have come to the UK, Spain, and even Nigeria were treated immediately, and that just didn't happen with HIV.
So HIV came originally, we think, from an animal. Mm-hmm. Ebola comes from an animal. The flu comes from an animal.
SARS comes from animals.
What about MERS?
MERS associated with camels, we think.
Bubonic plague is associated with fleas and rats.
That's correct.
Rabies with dogs and other wild animals. Lyme disease from ticks on deers. Yeah. These are all viruses that come from animals.
That's correct.
I want to come back and talk about that in a second because there seem to be a lot of them all of a sudden. Maybe they've always been around. We didn't know what they were, but I want to come back and talk about that with Dr. Dan Janis, professor of bioinformatics and genomics at UNC Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Education NC, a new nonprofit news source inviting the state to participate in a conversation about public schools at ednc.org. Nearly 3 million new jobs were created last year in the U.S., but these positions were largely for low-wage work. So Diane Rehm will be talking about this with a panel who's working to talk about who's working and who's not and prospects for the 2015 economy. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to talk about the flu or other viruses and how they are transmitted back and forth, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Somehow I've made it into my mid-30s never owning a car. I'm Ari Shapiro, international correspondent for NPR. The problem is, with my job, I travel so much in Europe that the minute I master which direction to look for oncoming traffic in London, inevitably, I go to a story in some European country where they drive on the other side of the street, almost get killed, then come back to London and almost get killed again. Whether you love to drive or not, you can turn your car into the programs you love.
Find out more about the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the flu and about viruses in general, and we're going to talk about this SupraMap that Dr. Dan Janis has developed. He's a professor of bioinformatics and genomics at UNC Charlotte. He'll be talking about much of what we're talking about, but probably in more detail and with visuals at the Science Cafe at UNC Charlotte's downtown campus at 320 East 9th on January the 15th. And that is open to the public. It's at 5 p.m. What were we talking about just prior to the break? Oh, we were talking about these animal the transmission of from animals to humans of these increasingly devastating diseases. And it all seems to be within the last part of the 20th century and the early parts of the 21st century. Surely that's not true, but why are we seeing it, or why are we more aware of it today than we were in 1950 or in 1890? Why?
Well, some of it is that the transport and trade in, you know, plants and animals is much more widespread. We have mosquitoes that were only tropical and Asian before, and now in the northern hemisphere, transmitting dengue and chikungunya virus.
And that's because we're bringing them in unwittingly on plants and other, and in cargo ships and in tires and things like that?
That's correct.
How much of it has to do with climate change?
Well, it has to do with like water in tires that are, you know, are shipped. People do see climate change being a factor over time, maybe midterm, if you know, the winters are not harsh enough to kill all these vectors. We have chikungunya as far north as Canada now, which was unthinkable a few years ago.
We didn't know what a bacteria was until suddenly we were able to see it in a microscope. I guess viruses are smaller than bacteria. Can they be seen in traditional microscopes, or do you have to have some special array to see?
Electron microscopes.
So that's a relatively recent invention in terms of modern of science. What exactly is a virus?
Some people say it's a living thing. Some people say it's a chemical reaction gone wrong or right. They're not interrelated. Only certain ones are interrelated. They're mostly sets of genes that have escaped from plants and animals and bacteria and continue to live on those hosts or among those hosts.
So are they genes? Is that what they are? Just a collection of genes?
A collection of genes.
And the reason they mutate, I don't understand this, so maybe you can explain it to me, is that the flu virus, at least, the reason it mutates is it has a very weak strand of RNA, mm-hmm. not DNA.
That's correct.
What's the difference?
It doesn't have error correction in its replication, and it can shuffle all the genes. So
is it a single strand versus a double helix? How would you describe the RNA versus DNA? I flunked biology. I just want you to know that right now.
In the case of influenza, it is a single strand. Yeah.
And that's why – and because it's weaker, yeah. it's more volatile?
Yes, yes.
Which makes it more dangerous?
Yes, yes.
Wow. Dennis emails, this may seem archaic, but – why not, before flu season, plant a known virus that you have a vaccine for? Would that fill the void of whatever was going to transpire and make us better able to fight the flu? I'm not sure what he means by plant. Maybe infect somebody with a known flu that we have a vaccine for?
Maybe he was referring to competition.
Okay.
You know, sort of.
To force out the new one.
Let's see. We've tried that with animals, you know, bringing in, predators of supposed pests, and then, you know, the predator animals take over and we have a worse situation. So that would be a really tough sell, I think. You know?
Okay. So we don't know what we don't know, and it's like an ecosystem.
Yeah.
If you remove one of the linchpins in the ecosystem, you don't know what's going to come tumbling down.
Yeah. There is a theory that you might want to direct the evolution of pathogens into a way that makes them go extinct. Hmm. But that's also, you know, very edgy science.
Is there anything comparable? A lot of people got involved in using these antibacterial soaps because, we're going to kill bacteria on the countertop and on our hands, and it's going to be a wonderful thing. And then we found out scientists came and said, don't do that. Don't use those products, because what you're doing is killing the weakest bacteria and leaving the strongest to thrive. And you're really putting yourself and your family and your health in danger. Are there things about virus that are similar that we may or may not know?
Yeah, certainly wash your hands, okay? And, with soap and hot water, and that will help a lot.
What is it about soap and hot water? Seriously, what is it about soap and hot water?
Breaks the cells open and kills the bacterial cells.
But a virus is not a bacteria.
Yeah, yeah. Washes them off, breaks their membranes, washes them off.
Okay. And cold water doesn't do that?
Not as well. I mean, hot water is a better solvent. Okay. You know. But back to Tamiflu for a second.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yeah.
If in 2009, because vaccine production lags the discovery of a new virus, Tamiflu was set up as a linchpin of pandemic preparedness, all right? And it was used widely. Any respiratory illness, the patient was given Tamiflu. Well, what happened was as early as 07, 08, we started to see Tamiflu resistance in seasonal H1N1, not the pandemic strain. And we predicted we were able to use some evolutionary biology and predict that that pressure of using so much Tamiflu would affect in pandemic H1N1 Tamiflu resistance. And we published that in 2010, and it has occurred.
How should we use Tamiflu?
We should diagnose every patient to the point of knowing exactly what strain of flu they have or another bacterium or virus. Same thing with antibiotics.
And your GP can do that?
Yeah. No. Well, there is equipment. It's not – and there is FDA-approved equipment.
Right.
It's just not – widely practiced.
So, if
the use of that equipment.
So, if we want to prevent what has happened with antibacterials, which have, in some cases, hurt people because it strengthens the bad bugs and kills the weak ones, you're saying the same thing can happen with overuse and incorrect use of Tamiflu.
Right.
So, how would you, as an individual, how would you, as a, you feel a little bad, and you've seen this commercial on television for Tamiflu, you shouldn't run to the drugstore and buy it and use it. You should go to your doctor, and the doctor needs the special equipment. Is he going to have it? Is he going to have access to it? What are you saying to do? Should we use it or not?
Well, we've advocated for better technology and at the point of care. We've written papers on that. I think until doctors really embrace genomics, it's not going to be widely adopted.
Wow. These antibacterial these things that come in a little squeeze bottle that we mm-hmm. clean our hands with at the drop of a bucket, that is killing the bacteria, good and bad, I hope. It has no effect on viruses, does it?
It kills viruses.
It does?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's a good thing to carry around and use during this season?
Yeah.
Okay. Dan emails, you let your guest get away earlier with a code word answer. Oh. Tradition. How do you decide which viruses are important for the year? Ah, the precarious perch of tradition. Hint, money, big pharma and money. Any comment?
I don't think pharma sees vaccines as a really great industry. Many companies have gotten out of it. I'm not an expert on that area, but government really has to prop up a lot of that industry.
So the development of vaccines is not driven by the profits of big drug companies, you're saying?
As an individual, I'm not an expert in that area, but I would say no. I mean, many big companies have gotten out of the infectious disease business. It's not like a blockbuster drug like heart disease.
You used to be at Ohio State.
That's
is that
great.
Right?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks
by
a
the
lot.
Way.
Thanks. What a tremendous year. Yeah.
You developed something while you were there, which I think you've improved on since then, called the Supra Map, which uses Google Maps to visualize genomic information about epidemic diseases. You've referred to it as a kind of weather map of disease. This is going to be the next big thing in television news. I see it coming. We're standing in front of the green screen talking about the spread of viruses across the planet. How does this work and how is it being used?
Okay, so first, let's be clear, the weather map's an analogy. But what we do is we take viral sequence information from all over the world from these central repositories. We make an evolutionary tree of that information, group them based on shared mutations. And we also take the metadata, the data associated with where and when they were collected. And we put all that information in context. And basically, we're drawing lines on the Earth representing how the virus is moving from place A to place B and coloring those lines to represent different mutations.
Now, I went on your website and I looked at this yesterday, and this looks not unlike if people have seen on television news the maps of where airplanes are going at any given time across the country. although you do it across the world. Yeah. It's, you're drawing lines from one airport to another airport, essentially with the airline map, where the and how many planes are up in the air. And the thing is literally the map of the United States is covered with lines. It looks the same way with your map.
Yes.
But it's disease. It's virus.
Yes, and we've also made a whole variety of visualizations. You'll see them at the Science Cafe, and one of them is very much akin to an airline route map. But you know, those are complicated, so we've even made it more simple now.
Who uses these maps?
Well, scientists around the world. We put up web-based applications such that people can create their own maps. We're not just making the map; but we're making the tools to create the maps themselves.
And who has access to it? Because you don't want some person in there putting in incorrect information. Who has access to it?
Well, we don't maintain any one map. We just give people the software to make a map, and it's up to them to publish it through peer review or sell it to their bosses as valuable. Yeah.
And as I understand, you can track infections from different animals as well as from humans, and you can go down to the street level.
Yeah. We have the technology – you know, provided through Google Maps and the quality of the metadata on the viruses. If we had lats and longs for each virus, there's no problem putting that on the map. It's just some privacy laws prevent us from doing that. Typically, we have county level data.
So what does that tell you when you go down to the county level or the street level if you're cheating and just curious because you're a scientist? What does that tell you? Are you able to see things? Is it revelatory? Do you have an aha moment that you can then call the local epidemiologist about and say, hey, here's what's going on and here's why it's going on?
Yeah, what we can see is, you know, oftentimes people like to say that hypotheses are either or. What we can say is that it's actually all context dependent. This was happening, you know, hypothesis A is happening in place A and hypothesis B is happening in place B. So it's context dependent temporally and spatially.
And this is changing constantly.
Yeah, and it will change. Yeah.
So you have you talked about giving people the ability to do their own maps with their own data.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody collecting all of these people's data as they put it in for their own purposes so we get an overall picture of everybody's data all at the same time?
Yeah, that's what we'd work towards. We're working on also combining the syndromic information and the genetic information, trying to bridge that gap.
So will this give us predictive ability that we don't have now, or will it give us I'm not even sure what the word is, the ability to more effectively treat or more quickly treat the problems?
All
or
the
both?
Above. You know, if your neighbors or countries that you're very connected to have a problem, then that's something you should prepare for. And if you know the nature of that problem, you can prepare precisely with the right kinds of treatments and medicine.
And are you doing this just with the flu, or are you doing it with other diseases, other viruses, bacteria, other outbreaks of other pathogens?
The technology can work on any kind of variation, so any kind of DNA or RNA variation. And all you need are the place names for the viruses. We typically don't have lats and longs. And if you want to animate it, the time of isolation.
How did you get to be the guy who came up with this?
Well, I worked in a variety of teams. I worked with a bunch of scientists at the American Museum of Natural History and at Ohio State. So it's all a team effort.
I saw that in your resume. Yeah. Why is the American Museum of Natural History involved in tracking disease?
It's really a center for really the school of thought called cladistics, really the processes.
I kept seeing that word too. Yeah. I don't know what cladistics is.
Evolutionary tree making, okay? Also called phylogenetics or systematics. And it comes out of the tradition of defining groups of animals based on shared features. And that is such a powerful idea, can be applied to DNA and RNA and viruses as well when we look at shared mutations in microbiology.
Hmm. What do you think the future of this new technology and this new ability is? How will it be used? How would you like to see it used? And what do you think the implications of its proper use will be?
I think one of the most important things is to move away from syndromic surveillance, where we're saying, well, you have some respiratory illness and the doctors will guess that you need an antiviral or you need an antibiotic. Mm-hmm. I think we have to diagnose the pathogen And then all that information will help the patient, every individual patient, be treated properly, but also aggregating that information and putting it into a map or other an evolutionary context will improve public health. So it's a win-win.
The flu can be deadly. Ebola usually is, and untreated HIV always is. What's the difference in those three different kinds of viruses? It's an impossible question.
Yeah. the way they infect people and people's immune reactions to them. Basically, the quality of healthcare is an incredibly important feature.
I read yesterday about 75% of recently emerging infectious diseases, 75% that affect humans are diseases of animal origin. Is this something new, or has this always been the case, and should we stay away from animals?
Well, certainly, yeah, the recognition of that. And we're animals too, but we just have, you know, better hygiene and better health care. But yeah, that's an important factor of how infectious disease operate.
Wow. Dr. Dan Janis, who is the Carol Grotnus Belk Distinguished Professor of Bioinformatics and Genomics at UNC Charlotte. He'll be talking about this again, by the way, on January the 15th at the Science Cafe at UNC Charlotte's downtown campus, or uptown campus if you prefer, at 320 East 9th Street at 5 p.m. with exciting I'm telling you, these are exciting visuals. You'll be able to see them. We couldn't do it on the radio. We tried. We just couldn't make it happen. Thanks very much for the hour. I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.